Thanks, Dave. I can't imagine a better way to introduce Steve Moore than to quote from an article. This is by David Glasner. He's an economist with the Obama administration. So here's what Mr. Glasner had to say. This is a quote. Moore has the dubious honor of being a member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal and the journal's senior economist. His contributions typify the journal's sad decline into a self-parody of obnoxious Philistine anti-intellectualism. Moore is unwilling to push back the frontiers of his own ignorance. Close quote. So there you have it. You can tell we're in for a real treat today. So we all know that God created economists in order to make the weather forecasters look good. Steve Moore, I'm happy to say, is the exception to that rule. He actually keeps a horseshoe in his office for good luck in his predictions. I asked him, you know, if he believes in that stuff, and he said, of course not. And I said, well, then why the horseshoe? And he says, well, it works whether you believe in it or not. And when I asked him which way the stock market was heading, he said he was extremely optimistic. And then I said, well, why do you look so gloomy? He said, well, I'm almost certain my optimism isn't justified. So maybe all of that is why Steve's outstanding columns in the Journal and the National Review and his commentary on CNBC and Fox and CNN and NPR are models of insight and clarity. So you've gotten his bio, and I just want to highlight a couple of points. Steve was my colleague for many years at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., and then he founded and served as president of the Club for Growth, which is one of the most influential and respected political organizations in the nation, helping to elect free market and tax-cutting candidates to Congress. Steve is the author of multiple books, hundreds of articles, and he's considered one of the architects of supply-side economics and an expert on both the flat tax and the fair tax. He was born in Chicago, raised in Illinois. He now lives in McLean, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. He has three sons. At Cato, Steve was our best tennis player. He also taught me a little economics, so I'm aware that the value of an introduction goes down when the supply of words exceeds the demand to hear them. So with that in mind, please join me in extending a warm welcome to Steve Moore.
Bob, thank you so much for that very unusual introduction. I very much appreciate it. I am an economist, I'll confess to that at the outset. And you all know economists are people who are good with numbers who just didn't have the personality to be an accountant. So it is wonderful to be with you all. Let me start by saying, you know, when I got here last night, my plane got in pretty late. I took the last flight out because I had to do a couple shows this morning. And so it was about 11 o'clock at night when I got into Fort Myers Airport, and I was pretty tired. I'm lugging my luggage through the airport, and this darling little old lady, she just ran up to me, and she just threw her arms around me. It was really very cute and endearing. And she was so excited. She said, I know you, don't I? And I said, well, ma'am, I'm not really sure. And she said, don't I see you on TV? And I kind of played along with her a little bit, and I said, well, I'm not sure, ma'am. I said, what do you watch? And she was a little befuddled by that, and she kind of scratched her head, and she looked up at me again, and she said, wait a minute. She said, didn't I see you on Wheel of Fortune last week? Yes, ma'am, that was me. How many of you are Fox News aficionados in the room? What would we do without Fox News, right? I do Greta Van Susteren's show about once a week, once every 2 weeks, and people are always asking me, what's Greta like? And I always say, Greta is absolutely perfect for Fox News. Fair, balanced, and blonde, right? And that's the formula for Fox. By the way, for those of you who do watch Fox regularly, you'll be happy to know that Fox News now at night has a larger audience than CNN, MSNBC, and CNBC combined. So that is very good news for those of us who are conservatives. How many of you read the Wall Street Journal editorial page? Raise your hand. Thank you for helping pay my salary. It is a really great newspaper, and I'm just so honored and privileged to be part of the Journal editorial page. Our philosophy at the Journal for the last 75 years has been free minds, free markets, and free people, and so it's just been wonderful to be part of it. I do think we're kind of the voice of the conservative movement, and for the students in here, the one piece of advice I would give you is if you want to be the smartest person in the room, take 10 or 15 minutes out of your morning and just read those three editorials. We write on every. It's a self-serving thing to say, but I think it works. And I also have good news, by the way, on that front. That the ratings just recently came out for the newspaper business, and of the five major newspapers in the country today, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times, LA Times, and the USA Today. Only one of those five newspapers has an increase in its circulation. Anybody want to guess what newspaper that is? The Wall Street Journal. So we're very pleased. And I don't know if I should say this, but I will. I don't want to be quoted on this, but I don't know how many of you looked at the New York Times circulation lately, but the New York Times is about this close to being in federal bankruptcy court. And it just couldn't happen to a nicer group of people. So just kidding. I just have to tell you one story that has nothing to do with politics and economics, but Bob got me into the mood of telling kind of a fun story. And I've been at the Journal now for 6 years, and one of the things we do is each week we do, on our Saturday paper, we do a long profile with a famous person. And I've interviewed a lot of really interesting people. I've interviewed Charles Schwab and Fred Smith, the CEO of Federal Express, and Barack Obama and John McCain and on and on. But about a year and a half ago, I interviewed maybe the most interesting person I have ever met in my life. And Reverend, you mentioned Jimmy Stewart, who I just love. But this is an icon up there with Jimmy Stewart. And I'm talking about a guy by the name of Art Linkletter. How many of you remember who Art Linkletter was? Well, Art Linkletter, I interviewed Art Linkletter when he was 96 and a half years old, lived up in Beverly Hills. I mean, this guy was unbelievable, right? He was the first major face of TV. I know the young people in this room are like, who the hell is Art Linkletter? But this guy was big, right? And I just enjoyed him so much. He was such a funny man and knew everybody in the golden age of Hollywood and everybody from Jimmy Stewart to Ronald Reagan to, Sophia Loren, all of them. And So I was asking him, I said, how big were you back then, Art, in the 60s and 70s? Because he had, that really famous TV show. And he said, Steve, I was Oprah before there was Oprah. I thought, that's pretty big, right? But he told me this one. Do you all remember the famous TV show he used to do called Kids Say the Darndest Things, where he brought up young people? And so I had to say to him, I said, sorry, I'm going to turn my, I didn't, I'm going to turn that off so it doesn't buzz. So I said to him, I said, what was your favorite story when you interviewed all these young kids over all the years? And he said, well, one time he brought a six-year-old boy up on the stage, and he's interviewing this boy. And in the middle of this interview, this little boy just starts bawling, and the tears are coming down his cheek. And Art says to him, son, why are you so sad today? And the little boy says, well, Mr. Linkletter, my dog just died. And so Art kind of consolingly put his arm around the little boy and said, son, I just want you to know you shouldn't feel so sad about this, I want to assure you of something, that right now your beloved dog is up in heaven with God. And the little boy turns to Art Linkletter and says, well, Mr. Linkletter, what would God want with a dead dog? And I just love that story. I mean, the kids really do say the darndest things, don't they? So, okay. Now I am going to get serious, and I want to talk a little bit about what's going on with this economy, a little bit about politics, and I'd love to take questions from you all. And let me start by saying this. As an economist, I believe that if you look at what's happened in the 4 years, we've now been 4 years into what we're calling the Great Recession, this terrible downturn in our U.S. economy. And I would make the case, and I'm going to be nonpartisan here, by saying that everything that has been done in Washington in the last 4 years, which includes the last year of the Bush administration and the first 3 to 3.5 years of the Obama administration, every single step that Washington has taken to get us out of this economic crisis has been exactly the wrong thing to do. Exactly the wrong thing to do. And we have made this crisis much deeper. We've made this this unemployment much higher than it would have been if we had done the right thing to do. And, you know, I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal about 3 or 4 months ago called Reaganomics versus Obamanomics. And all I did in this piece, very innocently, was I simply said, let's compare what happened with Reagan's program versus Obama's program. Because when you think about it, Reagan and Obama had something very much in common. They both took over during a great economic crisis. Reagan took over from the wreckage of Jimmy Carter. I always say the reason I know that God smiles on America is that Jimmy Carter was not reelected in 1980. And then, of course, Obama took over from an incredible crisis at the trough of this horrible downturn in the housing market. And so they came in almost precisely the same situations. And then I just simply said, well, let's look at the records, because of course Reagan came in with an agenda of cutting tax rates, of deregulating the economy, of trying to get spending under control, of fighting inflation. Of course, Obama has done just the opposite: massive stimulus spending, bailouts for companies. Remember the cash for Clunkers program, all of these programs, and the question is, which has worked better? And so I just recited some of the statistics, and they're really amazing. If you look at what happened in late 1983, about the same juncture of Reagan's presidency versus Obama's presidency, in November of 1983, you can look this statistic up, in November of 1983, the U.S. economy in 1 month created 1.1 million jobs. 1.1 million jobs in 1 month. That was the most jobs that have ever been created in any single month in American history. And of course, the recovery and expansion was just getting going. In the fourth quarter of 1983, the U.S. economy grew at a 6.5% growth rate. In the first quarter of 1984, we're now in the first quarter of, obviously, of 2012. In the first quarter of 1984, anybody want to take a guess at what the U.S. economy grew at? 8.3%. Can you imagine if we had an 8.3% economic growth rate right now? I mean, Barack Obama would be doing somersaults down Pennsylvania Avenue, right, if we had that kind of growth rate. I mean, the economy was booming so much at this stage of the Reagan presidency. If you go back and read what people were saying about the economy, the big worry at this stage of the Reagan presidency is the economy was overheating. It was overheating because we had so much job growth and so much growth in the economy. So that is that's what we should be striving for. These Republican presidents should be talking about that. How do we get back to 6, 7, 8% growth to dig ourselves out of this enormous hole that we're in? Now, let's look at some of the things that, by the way, Obama's record in the fourth quarter of 2011, the economic growth rate for the full year was 1.7%. 1.7% versus 8% under Reagan. Now, why has this all gone so wrong? What has gone wrong with Obama's presidency? Let me give you a few statistics that I think are frightening, and I'm not here to scare people, but these are kind of frightening numbers. If you look at what has happened under Barack Obama's presidency, and we go through the end of this year with this budget, Barack Obama has borrowed $5 trillion in 4 years. $5 trillion in 4 years. How much is that? Well, to put that in perspective, $5 trillion is more money than the United States government borrowed from 1776 through 2005. So think about that. The U.S. government is going to borrow more money in 4 years than we did for the first 220 years of our nation. It's unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, what wreckage that has done to our economy. I have a bumper sticker on my car that says, thank God Barack Obama doesn't know what comes after a trillion. Because, wow, I mean, what is it, quadrillion? I mean, these numbers are so huge, they're very frightening. And I have You know, I have, Bob mentioned that I have three kids. I have two teenage boys who I don't like at all, but I have an 8-year-old who I'm very fond of. And so my 8-year-old, when I'm at home at night, I try to tell my my 8-year-old son a bedtime story because I'm on the road a lot, and I just feel like this is an important thing for me to do as a father. So the other night, I thought I'd tell my son, David, a little something about the national debt. Because after all, he's going to have to repay it, so I thought he should know something about it. So I said, David, do you know how much money $1 trillion is? And he, you know, his eyes glazed over. So I said, well, David, let me ask you a question you do know the answer to. I said, who is the greatest basketball player in the world? And he instantly said LeBron James. And then I asked him another question he knew the answer to, because he's just got an encyclopedic knowledge of the NBA. I said, well, David, how much money does LeBron James make? And he knew that with his salary and endorsements that LeBron James makes $40 million a year. Is this a great country or what, that you can make $40 million to play basketball? So I posed this question to my son, David, and I'll pose the same one to you all. How many seasons do you think LeBron James would have to play basketball at $40 million a season to have $1 trillion? The answer to that is 25,000 seasons. 25,000 seasons. So we put ourselves in an enormous hole. And by the way, President Obama on Monday will be coming out with this new budget. And what we've seen some of the initial numbers. If we stay on the Obama baseline, we will borrow another $10 trillion over the next 10 years. So our national debt, did you all see a couple weeks ago the national debt went over the $15 trillion mark? Did you see that? Well, that means that we're going to go from $15 trillion to $25 trillion. So we need a reversal, of course. Now, if Barack Obama and his economists were here and so on, they would say, well, we had to do this. We had to spend all of this money to stimulate the economy, right? This was with the idea of the fiscal stimulus bill, that we're going to spend $1 trillion on all of these wonderful programs, and by the government spending the money, it's going to cause an economic recovery, right? That was the idea of the stimulus, the Keynesian multiplier effect. You know, every dollar the government's going to spend is going to cause $2 or $3 of economic activity, and we're going to have economic nirvana. Now, why didn't that work? Well, this is such an important point, especially for the students in this room. There is a superstition among economists that has never been validated by any data. In fact, it's been invalidated by history. There is a belief that government spending creates jobs, right? And I'm here to tell you this afternoon, government spending does not create jobs. And the reason that government spending does not create jobs is because of one of the most important insights of Bob Levy and my favorite economist of the last 100 years, Milton Friedman. And what Milton Friedman taught us, I mean, Milton's famous for a lot of things, right? But what he's probably, in my opinion, most famous for is, remember, he taught us this. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Remember that? There's no such thing as a free lunch. What does that mean? There's no such, it means if the government spends a dollar, the dollar has to come from somewhere. Right? I don't think, there are some few kids in this room, but not many, so I can say this in an adult audience. There's no tooth fairy out there, right? There's no tooth fairy. There's no free money. If the government's going to spend that dollar, it has to come from businesses and households and families. And when the government spends money, it's taking out of the economy exactly what it puts in. I mean, let me use a concrete example here, because I think this is an important point. I'm going to reach in my wallet, and I'm going to take out this $20 bill, and I'm going to give it to my good friend, Bob Levy. Bob, can you hold that? Now, I want that back when this demonstration is over. But okay, so the government, let's think about the illogic of Obamanomics. So let's say the government, you know, taxes me the $20 and gives it to Bob. Now, Bob's going to do all wonderful things, you know, with this money. He's going to buy a toupee, right? Or he's going to go to Walmart. Or he's going to go to McDonald's or something like that, right? And so this is going to stimulate the economy, right? I mean, this is what the Obama economists say. That $20 that Bob has, we just stimulated the economy. Well, what's wrong with that calculation? What's wrong with that? Bob's $20 richer, but I'm $20 poorer. Have we injected any stimulus into the economy? Of course the answer to that is no. I mean, why don't these numbskulls in Washington understand that? I mean, obviously the answer is no. In fact, at the very best, this is what we as economists call a zero-sum game, right? We've just transferred $20 from me to him. But I would make the case to you, and this is very important because this tax debate on fairness is going to be at the centrality of the political debate over the 9 months. I would make the case to you that this transaction is not a zero-sum game. It's a negative-sum game. And why is that? because I worked to get the $20 and Bob stole it from me, right? And that is not a way to create wealth. Now I will take that $20 back, yeah, before I forget. But, you know, what are the other two ways the government can... Now, they can tax us, right? What are the other two ways the government can get money to spend it? I'm going to ask the young kids in this room. How else can they get the money? Sir?
Sell things.
What? Sell things, but that's not what I was driving at. What else? How else can government get money? Print it, right? They can print it. They can literally turn the printing presses on, create money, and then spend it. And, of course, that's what the Fed is doing right now. And I think it's very dangerous. I think that Ron Paul is onto something when he says we need more oversight of the Federal Reserve because we put all this power in the Fed. Over the last 3 years, the Fed has printed over $2 trillion. They're buying up mortgage-backed securities. They're buying up the debt and so on. And then you have to ask the question, when the government prints money, does that stimulate the economy? Does that make us richer? Well, I hope everyone in this room understands the question, answer to that question is no. Because if you believe that does make countries richer, then Argentina, Bolivia, and Mexico would be the richest countries in the world, right? Because that's all they do is print money. I mean, think about this, again, for the young people in this room. If everybody in this room could magically put an extra zero on every bill that you have in your wallet. So your $10 is worth 100, and your $20 is worth 200, my one is worth 10, and your five is worth 50. Have we made everyone richer? Of course the answer to that is no. It simply means everything is going to be more expensive. Now what's the third way the government can get the money to spend it? It can borrow it. And that's what I was talking about in terms of this massive increase in the national debt. And, of course, that doesn't make countries any richer either because it doesn't even inject any more money into the economy because when the government borrows $5 trillion, guess what? Somebody, the people in this room and everybody around the world, has to buy $5 trillion of the bonds, right? So you haven't injected any money into the economy. This is the central fault of what Barack Obama has done. And if we don't get this spending under control, I don't see how this economy can expand. I really believe we are at a, you know, I believe every generation in America has had a calling. You know, when you go back to our founding fathers who gave up their, you know, their lives, their fames, and their fortunes to win the Revolutionary War. And then we had the generation that won the Civil War to end the scourge of slavery and our grandparents who fought World War I and the greatest generation. Many of you are members of the greatest generation that lived through the Depression and fought World War II. And then we won the Cold War. Every single generation has had a calling. And for the young people in this room, I would say your calling, the biggest challenge you all are going to face is dealing with this enormous national debt. I mean, what we have been engaged in over the last 5 years has been the biggest, boldest episode of fiscal child abuse in the history of this country, when you think about it, because who's going to pay these bills? Of course, it's going to be the next generation. So that's something we have to get straightened out, and I feel very passionate about that. I want to mention a couple of other quick issues. One is taxes. I did have this piece in the Wall Street Journal this week about fairness. I just want to give you some of these statistics because I find them to be extraordinary. I wonder how many of you are aware of these. But if you take the richest 1% in America, right, the evil richest 1%, the people like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and Tiger Woods and Lady Gaga, you know, evil people like that. Anybody want to take a guess at this room? What percentage of the federal income tax is paid by the richest 1 out of 100 Americans? Boy, you guys are well, 40%, exactly. You must be reading the Wall Street Journal editorial page because we recite that figure every day. Most Americans have no idea of that. In fact, I saw a poll the other day by my friend Scott Rasmussen. The average American thinks the top 1% pay less than 1% of the taxes. Why? Why do they believe that? Because that's what the politicians, that's what Barack Obama says all the time. The rich don't pay their fair share. The media says it. So we've been inundated and brainwashed with this concept that the richest don't pay their fair share. It is a complete lie that Warren Buffett pays a lower tax rate than his secretary. It's simply not true. Every study shows that is not the case. The richest 10% in America, you know what percentage of tax they pay? 69%, almost 70% is paid by 10%. Now, here's the other flip side of this that I find troubling as an economist. The bottom 40% in America, the bottom 40%, do you know what share of taxes they pay? Zero. That is a big problem. You know, Bob Levy will vouch for this, but I'm probably as anti-tax as anybody in this room. But I do believe this. I sincerely believe this. That if you're going to be a citizen of this country and you're going to vote and you're going to work in this country, Every American should pay some income tax. Every American should pay some income tax. And by the way, both parties, Republicans and Democrats, are responsible for taking more and more Americans off the income tax roll. So this is going to be a central challenge for whoever the Republican nominee might be. Can they defend capitalism? Can they defend the system? I mean, the problem, I'm not here to bash any candidates. I don't like any of them, quite frankly. But you know, Mitt Romney, if he's going to be the Republican nominee, he is going to have to be able to defend wealth and job creation and capitalism, right? And I just think, you know, he is challenged in that way because he sometimes feels guilty about his wealth. A couple of other quick issues I want to mention. I gave a talk to the Republican House members at their retreat 2 weeks ago, and one of the things that I told them is that the single most important thing we have to do for this country right now, the most urgent thing, is simply this. We must repeal Obamacare. Obamacare has got to be, and you're seeing this debate that is going on right now with contraceptives and so on. If you read our editorial page, we put this in the broader context. The reason this debate is important has nothing to do with birth control or contraceptives or abortion. I mean, everybody in this room probably has different opinions on that. What this is about is individual freedom. And this is the tip of the iceberg, folks. This is the tip of the iceberg, because if we pass Obamacare, every single personal decision about your health care and your medical care is going to be determined by bureaucrats in Washington, right? They will determine whether you can have that hip replacement surgery, whether you can get that new cancer treatment, whether you can get that new stroke drug, all of these things, alternative medicine. All of those decisions are going to be taken away from you and me and you, and they're going to be put in the hands of central planners in Washington. What we need in this country, I wrote this in our editorial the other day, we need separation of health and state, right? Separation of health and state. We should divorce government and let private individuals make these decisions. It's interesting, by the way. The two sectors of the American economy that had the most rapid rate of inflation over the last 15 years, you know what those two industries are? You guys are a smart audience. Yes, healthcare, medical care, and education are the two industries where we've had the most massive rise in prices. If you look at consumer items that face competition, cars and trucks, clothing, computers, software, those have been falling in price. But medical care costs are shooting out of control, and education is even worse. Medical care costs have risen by 50% over the last 15 years. Education costs have risen by 100%. By the way, just as an aside, I mentioned I have two kids that are teenagers. They're both in college right now. My oldest son goes to Northwestern. Anybody want to take a guess at what Northwestern costs all in right now? Well, it's costing me $58,500 a year. Tuition in America today is the biggest scam in this country, how much these universities are charging. And, you know, I really believe it's true. We need much more accountability in universities. But here's the point. When my son was about to leave for college last year, I said to him, you know, because, look, I'm conservative. I'm not that wild about him going to a liberal school like Northwestern anyway. So I said, Justin, before you go, I just want to put this on the table. You can go to Northwestern for 4 years, or as an alternative, I'll just write you a check for $200,000. You play computer games for 4 years, and we'll both be better off. He said, yeah, that sounded pretty good to him. So, but you have to wonder, college really worth $200,000? But the healthcare is the same way. Why are these costs out of control? Because we've created government systems that are third-party systems where the people who are getting the service aren't the ones who are paying for them. So we need to clean that up. One other issue, I want to talk about one optimistic issue, something that's really going right in America that I'm just so excited about because I've been writing about it a lot lately, and that is what's happening in this country with our energy policy. And I'm just so excited about this. I mean, let me just lead with the headline here. If we get our energy policy right in America today, we have the capability within the next 10 or 15 years to be completely energy independent. And that means we need to drill, baby, drill. We have so much. What is going on in this country with oil and natural gas is amazing. I mean, Barack Obama has the energy story in America 100% wrong. Right? Where has he been putting all the money? In wind and solar power and all these bad, you know, boutique energy sources that they can't provide. Anybody want to take a guess after $15 billion in the last 4 years that we spent on wind and solar power? Anybody want to take a guess at what percentage of our electricity today comes from wind and solar power? 3%. We're up to 3%. Isn't that woohoo? We're up to 3% with our energy coming from wind and solar. Where do we get our electricity from? Coal, natural gas, nuclear power. But what's going on, let me just give you a couple examples. I was in the town of Wheeling, West Virginia recently. How many of you have ever been to Wheeling, West Virginia? Wheeling, for those of you who were there, you know, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, Wheeling is one of the most depressed areas in the country. I mean, it is the epicenter of the Rust Belt in America. I mean, you go there. I was there 5 years ago. Man, it's closed down steel factories and closed down factories all over the place, and every other store is shut down and so on. I mean, incredibly depressing place to be. I was there this summer. Wheeling, West Virginia, folks, is booming. Why is that? Wheeling, West Virginia sits atop something called the Marcellus Shale in this country. We have 75 years of natural gas under the Marcellus Shale. And thanks to this new process called fracking, it is unbelievable how much natural gas we're getting. And so this town is booming. The farmers are making all this money on royalties and so on. I mean, they're opening up a BMW dealership in Wheeling, West Virginia. I mean, it's becoming so prosperous. So that's a great story. Now, the other place that's growing rapidly is, okay, I'm going to do a quiz question for you all. A dollar for the person who gets this question right. What state in the United States has the lowest unemployment rate today? Wow, North Dakota. I go a lot of dollars. A lot of you shouted out. The unemployment rate in North Dakota today is negative. It's negative. They have 40,000 unfilled jobs in North Dakota. Every time I see a panhandler in Washington, D.C., I say, you want a job? Go to North Dakota. That's where they've got all the jobs. But it is extraordinary what's going on there. They've discovered oil in what's called the Bakken Shale in North Dakota. North Dakota has now become the third largest oil-producing state in this country. And it's unbelievable what's going on here. By the way, Obama, every single step that he took credit for the oil and natural gas boom in his State of the Union speech. I talked to oil executives. Every single step that Obama has taken through his EPA interior has been to try to shut this industry down because they think fossil fuels are evil. But North Dakota is an amazing place. I was there 2 weeks ago. And we had a story in in the Wall Street Journal, so it must have been true, on the front page, and it said that you've got tens of thousands of people who are moving out of California now to North Dakota because there's so many jobs there. They said even the hookers are moving to North Dakota because they can get $1,000 a night there. So it's just an amazing story what we could do if we get our energy policy right. All right, I've used too much of my time, so I'm just going to end with one last issue and then take some questions. I believe for our nation today, I mean, this is going to be an incredibly important election coming up. I mean, I really believe it's going to be a conflict of visions about where this country is headed. Not the most important election in the last 50 years. I think the 1980 election was the most important one. But this is going to be a pretty darn important election. If Obama's reelected on January 1st, 2013, we're going to see the biggest tax increase in the history of this country. Capital gains taxes are going up. Dividend taxes are going up. Small business taxes are going up. Payroll taxes. So that is a very fearful thing. This is really important. And what it's going to be about, in my opinion, and I think both parties, quite frankly, ladies and gentlemen, have been very deficient on this, is competitiveness. Are we going to make America a competitive country? And if you think about it, for all of our lives, for at least the last 75 years, the United States has been the unrivaled economic superpower in this country, right? And we've been the unrivaled military superpower. And you know what? I believe Ronald Reagan was right, that it was divine providence that put us here, that this was kind of preordained, that we would be the superpower. And we've been a force for good, not evil. There were periods when people thought that other countries were, remember there's that period when people thought Japan was going to catch us and take us, and they've been in a 20-year recession. Remember when people thought the Soviet Union was going to catch us, and you know they just relying all about their statistics. But here's the interesting thing. Now we are in a situation where we do have an honest-to-goodness rival. Right, and that is China, obviously. And what is happening in China is extraordinary. I mean, I don't know how many of you have been to China recently. I was there 2 years ago. It's an amazing place. I mean, the growth is just off the charts. I mean, it really shows what happens when you move from socialism. And here's a country under Mao Zedong. This is a guy who starved to death 100 million of his own people. Right, and now the place is booming. They're exporting food. It's just a marvelous thing to see. I'm not saying that they're a completely free country. Far from it. They have a long way to go to get to freedom. But they've moved from the extreme left to having private property rights and towards capitalism. And their living standards are doubling every 8 years. So it's an amazing success story. And we had a meeting about a year and a half ago with the economic minister of China, who came by the journal editorial page. And he's a big muckety muck in the hierarchy of power in in Beijing. He's like the number four guy in the chain of command. And he's talking about all the wonderful things that are going on in China. And you know, it's very impressive, obviously. And then he said that at the end of his little talk, he said, we calculate in our models in Beijing that in 8 years, by the year 2019, he said, we are going to catch the United States. And then he said, he didn't quite put it like this, but he was a very arrogant guy, and it came out like this. He said, once we catch you people, we're just going to leave you in a cloud of dust, right? We're just going to speed right by you. And obviously, he's looking at the U.S. economy, which has obviously been in this deep recession, and their economy isn't growing. So you can see why they might think that. And you all don't know me very well, but if you bleed me, if you cut me, I bleed red, white, and blue. I mean, I just love this great, great country. So I couldn't take this much longer. And I sprang out of my chair, and you're not supposed to do that at these meetings, but I couldn't help it. And I just said, sir, what you've accomplished in China is, you know, a miracle, and I want to salute you for this. But I said, not in my lifetime, I assure you, will China surpass the United States. And I said, and that will not happen because our Chinese are so much smarter than your Chinese. Yeah. he didn't like that very much, but right, it's true. I mean, yeah. So that is my story. The point I'm making, if we get this right, last point, if we get this right, if we fix our tax system through a flat tax, if we get this spending down and debt down, if we fix our healthcare system, if we do all of these things, ladies and gentlemen, you are going to see the biggest boom in this economy you ever saw. So thank you very much for having me. It's been a great privilege to be with you.
Well, we have a couple presentations for you first, but I do want to comment because you've been educating us on a lot of things. And we're going to give you a couple books to help educate you about this area. But first, I want to mention something about education. Last week, there was a nice article in the Wall Street Journal called A Fairness Quiz for the President. Many of you probably read that. I get to ask you about one of these. Is it fair that President Obama sends his two daughters to elite private schools that are safer, better run, and produce higher test scores than public schools in Washington, D.C., but millions of other families across America are denied that free choice and forced to send their kids to rotten schools? That was one of about a dozen and a half fairness questions in Steve's article last week. We do want to make a couple book presentations to you. First, a nice book on Naples, Florida.
Thank you.
From the Forum Club, and a nice book on Marco Island that's donated by one of our members. And I'll be happy to put them at your place. But you do get other benefits besides the wonderful benefits you've had joining us today. We do have over 400 members capped at that. We have 378 on the wait list. But since you are a speaker, you may jump the wait list and become a member at any time.
All right, I'll be here. Okay. I will be here.
Bob is going to bring forth some of the questions. I get to ask the first one just because I like to ask questions. Recently, the Fed announced a zero rate policy. This is one of my favorite things to talk about. A lot of implications there, a lot of things going to happen because of that. Any quick thoughts about a zero rate policy till 2014?
Well, it's a great question about what the Fed is doing. And, you know, I mentioned the fact that the Fed has been just pumping this economy with money. So what's happened in the last 3 years has not just been this record amount of debt that I was talking about, but also a massive infusion of money printed on the printing presses. And that's a big problem, I think. We've had zero interest rate policy from the Fed now for 3 years. If you look at what's happened to the value of the dollar and you look at what's happened to the price of gold, I mean, just to give you one example. When Barack Obama came, remember, Reagan said, we are going to make the dollar as good as gold again. And I think that was one of the reasons that we had this incredible expansion in the 80s and 90s, restored price stability, that the dollar today was worth what it would be 5 years from now. Under Obama, in just 3 years, the price of gold has gone from $850 an ounce to $1,700 an ounce. Now, why is that? Why are people bidding up the price of gold? And it's because they're losing confidence in our paper currency, right? And if you think about it, one of the negative implications of this enormous debt, think about what countries do historically when they get in a perilous cycle of debt. What do? How do they pay back the creditors? they rev up the printing presses, right? They debase their currency and devalue their currency and pay back the creditors with paper currency that isn't worth anything. So I think it is very dangerous. I think it's a great question. We have to get back to sound currency, low tax rates, and cutting government spending. This isn't complicated.
I'm going to combine a couple of questions from some students. Regardless of who's president or what economics we practice, is it ever going to be possible to get out of a $5 trillion debt? And related to that, how do politicians reconcile the desire to keep taxes low to stimulate the economy with the need to address the national debt?
Well, the answer is yes. Of course we can get out of this debt crisis. It's not that difficult. If we get back to pro-growth economic policies, I think that we're going to see a burst of growth. What does growth mean? It means you put more people back to work, which means less people are collecting government benefits. I don't know if you saw the study that came out the other day. Two-thirds of Americans now are collecting a check from the government every 2 weeks. I mean, look what's happened to food stamps. Look what's happened. I mean, Newt Gingrich had it exactly right. This is President Food Stamps, right? He's also President Medicaid. He's President Unemployment Insurance. What we have done on a grand scale, Bob, over the last 3 years is we just keep putting more and more people on government benefits, and that's simply unsustainable. But if you get growth, you take people off government benefits, which reduces the outflow of government money, and you have more money that comes in. I mean, a perfect example is what happened in the 1980s. Ronald Reagan cut the highest income tax rate from 70% to 28%. Remember that? Our highest rate went from 70 to 28%. Now, what do you think happened to tax revenues over that period? Did they fall or did they go up or did they go down? They went up. We doubled the tax revenues with the lower tax rates. That's something that we call the Laffer curve effect. So, yeah, if we get growth back and we get serious about controlling this expenditure crisis, yeah, we can get this national debt down. We need to grow the economy faster than the debt is going up. And so this is the hope for the young people in this room, is that we're going to see a comeback of capitalism, as my friend Steve Forbes said. We need a comeback of capitalism, and if we get it, I mean, I think the future for the young people in this room is really unbridled. I really believe that.
A political question from several people. I'll combine them. Does Obama deserve all the blame? Does not Congress get a good deal of the blame? Will America's drift towards socialism slow if more conservatives are elected? And has the Republican who will make a difference appeared yet?
Huh. Yeah, that's kind of a fun question. Let me just say this, that, what you're watching now, in my opinion, in the Republican primaries for president, you're watching the JV team, right? This is not the varsity team. This is the JV. How many of you agree with me that you're not happy with this field? And, the thing, and Bob and I were talking about this at lunch, that the tragedy is Republicans have an incredible field of exciting candidates. I mean, Your senator here, Marco Rubio. I mean, I love this guy. This guy is a superstar, and he has an incredible gift of communications. The guy I'd like to see run for president is Chris Christie of New Jersey. I mean, I think the guy is just a superstar. I know Chris very well, by the way, Bob. And I saw him about a month ago, right after he made the decision to not run. And I said, Chris, I love you, but I said, you really disappointed me. I just said, I think this is, because remember he said, this isn't my time. And I said, Chris, you're exactly wrong. This is your time. People want your toughness and your ability to communicate a message and so on. And then I told him, look, Chris, you're completely wrong about this not being your time. A new poll just came out. I don't know if you saw this. 40% of Americans are obese. So he has 40% of the of the vote, locked up right there. But this is a serious thing, because I really think that in my lifetime, there have been three politicians who have really stood above the rest in terms of their ability to communicate a message with the American people: Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama. There's something, whether you like them or not like them, they filled up a room when they walked into that room, and they had an ability to connect with people. Bob, I believe Chris Christie, he has that X factor. He has that ability to connect with people. So let's hope for a brokered convention and we draft Chris Christie for president. In terms of, what was the other question about Republicans? Let me just say this about Republicans. All right. There's an old story. Here's the way I feel about these two parties. And this is a story, some of you have heard me tell this before. But, you know, it's the story about the two little boys, one 6 years old and one 5 years old. And they're going to go down for breakfast one morning. And the 6 year old says to his little brother, "When we go downstairs for breakfast, let's each say a curse word to mom." So they start giggling. And the 6 year old says, "I'm going to say the word hell to mom, and you say the word ass to mom." So they're giggling. They go downstairs. And they're sitting at the kitchen table. And the mother unsuspectingly says to the 6 year old boy, "Son, what would you like for breakfast this morning?" He kind of cleverly says, "What the hell, Mom? I think I'll have Cocoa Krispies." Well, this mother just erupts in anger. She is so angry about this vulgar language this young boy has just used. She reaches across that table, grabs him by his scrawny little neck. She's shaking him. She tosses him in the corner of the room, and he collapses in a heap. He's moaning, and she says, "You go up to your room. You never use that kind of language in this house again." So he goes upstairs, and meanwhile, the 5-year-old has been watching this Mount St. Helens eruption from his mother, and he's now in a state of terror himself, and she's wagging her finger right at his face and says, "And you, young man, what do you want for breakfast this morning?" And he's stammering, can barely get the words. I said, "Oh, Mom, I'm not really sure, but you can bet your sweet ass it ain't Cocoa Krispies." But, you know, that's our two parties, right? That's our two political parties. One party gets it wrong. The other one comes in, learns all the wrong lessons, and we keep passing the baton. So don't put too much faith in any one political party. We just need a leader who believes in the free enterprise system. This isn't complicated. All we need to do is get the government the hell out of the way, and we're going to see a boom in this economy. I believe that.
The best line I heard about supporting Chris Christie would be is that he would be the first United States president visible from outer space.
Even Newt would vote for him.
If you could enact policies to correct all of our economic problems, what would be the top three? And related to that, will the fair tax make it? And related to that, shades of Henry George, beyond the fair tax or the flat tax, how about a limited national real estate tax and no other tax?
I think if we could put in place a radical reform on our income tax system, it would be like rocket fuel for this economy. I don't care if it's the – I mean, I kind of like – you know, the candidate I really liked, I have to confess. You know, we're not at the Journal. We don't take sides in this stuff. But I liked Herman Cain. You know, I thought Herman was a great communicator of the free market message. And being a businessman, I just really respected that. That's important. And he had the 999 plan, and Newt Gingrich has the 16% flat tax. But the main thing we need to do, we need to move towards a system, in my opinion, that gets the rates way down, on businesses and on individuals. So let's say we get that rate down to 18%. We get rid of all the double tax on saving and investment and risk-taking and business creation. And then you get rid of all the loopholes. Get rid of all of it. You know, let's just have the postcard tax return that takes 5 minutes to fill out. I think if you do that, you're going to see an extraordinary boom in this country because all the capital that is leaving the country now will come back. In other words, what I'm saying is let's move from being the highest tax country to the lowest tax country. I mean, we have a system right now, we have a 35% corporate income tax. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the second highest corporate tax rate in the world. Only Japan has a higher corporate tax rate than we do. And guess what happens in April of this year? Japan is cutting their corporate tax rate. So, Bob, we'll be number one, right? We'll have the highest corporate. Now, why does that matter? Why does it matter that we have the highest corporate tax rate? What it means is that we're at 35%. The rest of the world is at 20 to 25%. Every American company is starting with a 10 percentage point disadvantage. It's like we're putting a toll or tariff on our own goods and services. And we got to bring those rates down. I mean, my God, we're 15 percentage points above the tax rate in Sweden today, and Sweden is socialist. So bring those rates down. You know, Bob knows this because he and I used to have offices very close to each other. But I've got one of these old Snoopy cartoons on my wall in my office. And remember when Snoopy used to sit on the top of his doghouse and type out little messages, and he's typing on it, tapping on his typewriter, and it says, "Dear IRS, please take me off your mail list." And I always love that. You know, I mean, it's just resonating. So I do like the. How many of you are fans of the fair tax in this room? Getting rid of the. I mean, I like that idea a lot. You know, let's tax people on what they take out of the economy is what we consume, not what we put into the economy. Our work effort, our entrepreneurship and our investment.
There was a faction at Cato that favored Herman Cain until the polls came out and showed that 45% of American voters, that's 55 million people, claim to have been sexually harassed by Herman Cain. China, these are China and India-related questions. China holds our U.S. debt. What would happen if the U.S. defaulted on the debt to China? With continued budget deficits, who will buy our debt to support the USA? And then, of course, related, why does the USA give money to China and then borrow it back from them?
Yeah, that's a great question. On the debt issue, you know, it's true that most $1 trillion of our debt right now is owned by China. And when you go back to the example I was using, that we are now in this titanic battle, right, with China about who is going to have world supremacy in terms of the economy. Well, if we're battling with them, do you want to be the creditor or the debtor in that situation? You want to be the creditor nation, not the debtor nation. So this does, in my opinion, Bob, put us at a competitive disadvantage that we owe these the Chinese so much money. And here's the interesting thing. Every time that Tim Geithner or all of these Obama officials or the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, go over to China, the first thing the Chinese officials say is, you know, we're not going to buy $10 trillion of your bonds over the next 10 years. We're not going to do it. In fact, China over the last year has been selling more U.S. bonds than they've been buying. They've been disinvesting U.S. bonds. What that suggests is if people stop buying U.S. bonds, what's going to happen? Interest rates are going to have to rise, right, because the market has to clear. And the danger here is, when you think about it, the biggest debtor in the world today is the United States government. If think about the fact that we had this super committee, they were trying to cut $1.5 trillion of the budget over the next 10 years out of $40 trillion in spending. They couldn't even do that. Remember, they couldn't even get $1 trillion in savings. Well, think about this. If the interest rate rises just by just 1 percentage point, so right now, you know, the 10-year Treasury bill is at less than 2%. So if it just goes from 2% to 3%, which is still, as you know, Bob, way below the, you know, the historical average for interest rates, every percentage point increase in interest rates is the equivalent of $1 trillion of extra spending that we have to do to pay our debt. So let's say we had a 300 basis point increase in interest rates. That's $3 trillion. My point is, Bob, we're very vulnerable right now because we've amassed so much debt to increases in interest rates. And I'll make a bet to anybody in this room that if you were nice enough to have me back in the Foreign Club 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, I'll bet $100 to any and all takers that interest rates are going to be higher than they are today. Now, that's not a very bold bet, is it? Right? That's not a very bold bet because they can't go any lower. In fact, for the young people in this room, you know, the 18 and 19-year-olds, you're going to talk to your great-grandkids and you're going to say, you know, there was a time in the United States when interest rates were only 2%, you know, because I don't think we're ever going to see this again. It's the one thing that's kind of holding the economy together is these interest rates are so low. So it's a very scary situation. I mean, it really is. I mean, the real question Americans have to ask when they go to the polls is, can we really afford 4 more years of this? I mean, you think Obama's been liberal the last 4 years? Think about if he doesn't have to face the voters again in 4 years. I mean, think of how far left he might move the. And look, again, I'm not for either party right now. I mean, I think both parties are pretty dysfunctional, but I'm not so sure we can afford 4 more years of these policies.
You know, I think it's fair to say that the major media are pretty well dominated by the political left, and so when you hear a voice like Steve Moore, you know that the voice of conservatism and libertarianism is still present, at least at some world-circulated newspapers. So please join me in a thank you and a great appreciation for a provocative and entertaining talk.